You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm honored to have as my guest a Somalian writer, Nuruddin Farah. He is the author most recently of Secrets, published by Arcade Books, and will be speaking primarily of that, a trilogy of his books, Sardines, Co's Sesame, Sweet and Sour Milk, were published here by Grey Wolf Press, and Secrets is itself, as I understand, the culmination of a trilogy that began with a book called Maps, continued with Gifts, and the third is Secrets. Now, I want to let listeners know that this is a special event for me because some 12 years ago, I was talking to Grace Paley. Now, if you know Grace Paley and her work, you will also know how excited I am whenever I'm talking to her. And I always ask her to recommend books to me because who wouldn't want to read anything Grace Paley loves? And for the longest time, the book that Paley would always mention to me was Maps by my guest Nuruddin Farah, a magnificent book, but Secrets, his newest, is equally magnificent, and I wanted to begin by conferring the special beneficence of Grace Paley on the occasion of this interview. Like Grace's work, the adult comes from the child. It's very much the childhood miracle and wonder that gives rise to the adults of these novels. And I wonder if we could start by speaking about childhood as a locus point.
Yes, well, perhaps it makes sense to think that it's only when you are older, or rather the older you get, the clearer your childhood becomes. And the reason is because distance distills. Distance enables you to see certain things with clarity because you're no longer threatened by your childhood anymore. And then since by the time you get to my age, I'm now about 53, you can reinvent your life through fiction by revisiting some of the aspects of your childhood. Now, these have been occasioned by my need to talk about some of the things that have happened in Somalia of disastrous consequences, you know, like the Ogaden War, which has given birth to Maps, published in 1987 by Pantheon in New York, and which also be republished, in fact, next year. Arcade are bringing out.
Oh, wonderful. So the whole trilogy.
The whole trilogy will have the same shape, design, in fact, so that people will be able to read them for the first time together in North America.
Now, Secrets adumbrates the civil war in Somalia, and its nature is to say that the clan wars in Somalia are something like lifting a rock to find a scorpion and then trying to see in turn what the scorpion guards. So it's a system, both narratively as well as perceptually, of hidden and guarded against things.
Yes, I would agree with you. Not only that, but in fact, I might even, short of making myself a fool of myself, I would say that the ideas generated by the clan, especially in the minds of non-Somalis, is comparable to the ideas generated by the mafia in foreign minds. And therefore, they become a mystery. And then they create their own energy. They create their own negative vitality. But if there is anything that I wanted to say in secret, it's also that the Klan is a very fictive but also diseased phenomena. And the reason is because since the line of the Klan is drawn through the male side of the family, if it is proven that you are not the blood son, the biological son or daughter of someone, then could you be said to belong to that clan? Or, in actual fact, doesn't everything that is associated with the clan make you think that one moves away from being rational? And the reason is because when you say, if you define yourself, I am of this clan, you're actually saying something that's very difficult to define, because you're not saying anything. You are simply making a generalization.
Now, in this novel, Secrets, by my guest Nuruddin Farah, the hero, whose name is
Kalaman,
falls in love with something, well, has always been in love since childhood, with a woman who is something of a demon or shapeshifter. And pronounce her name for me.
Shalongo.
I don't want to make mistakes as I go along. Now, she is so fascinating. She appears in the book in the hero's apartment without a key. She smells peculiarly. The hero asks her. She says, lice. It turns out she keeps them in a bottle, and what smells is the jelly on which they live. But the inference is that all things parasitic and fuming, pestiferous, adhere to her, and she really does enter this narrative both in spiritual, shape-shifted guises and in somewhat explicable ones. She appears, it seems, at one point as an elephant charging a hunter who's stolen the tusks. But the rumor is, of course, that this has been story, that she's come dressed as an elephant performing a symbolic revenge. Who is she? And you know...
Well, it's very difficult to define Shalongo, because if I knew who Shalongo was, I would not probably have written the novel. It was wanting to discover who Shalongo was, in the same way as wanting to discover who Misra was made me write maps. I'm drawn, for one reason or another, I'm drawn to very, very strong women, and women who challenge my imagination. And I'm also drawn to the fact that life is not good or bad. People are not good or bad, but people are many things to many of us. Shalongo, although she happens only to narrate one of the chapters of the novel, whereas everybody else, in fact, Nono, who is Kalaman's
grandfather
narrates more than 2-3 chapters, and yet she seems to pervade, she seems to be totally pervasive, to the extent where some people think that she is the principal character of the novel. Now, that interests me greatly, because when I write a trilogy, and because I'm diseased with trilogies, I always write trilogies, I like to take a novel where the central consciousness is absolutely clear, where you could simply say, this is the person who occupies the central, who is the central consciousness of this novel. And then I take another novel where it is not very obvious. and then do another one where the same thing applies. So that in both maps as well as secrets, you couldn't say with certainty that the principal character of the novel is this person. So that the idea was to tell a story in a web where the story is already woven, and then what you do is you follow the threads of that web so that the patterns are done differently with each new character. Each new character who comes in would say his or her piece so that you're able to stitch the story, so to speak.
So we're hearing from many points of view. And in fact, fascinating to me is that the book seems to be in some way structured around moments of great privacy. Nono spies in the middle of the book on his grandson who is masturbating in the shower. At the end of the book, Nono is spied on in the act of prayer. And it seems as if there is a thread running between the privacy of the act of masturbation and the privacy of the act of prayer on the part of a man whose nickname, after all, is He Who Does Not Pray.
Yes. Yes. But there is also something that links almost all of them. What links almost all of them, either in the name of the shop, which a young man, the computer business, which a young man
murders.
Yes, runs. Or in the crow who pays a visit to Kalaman soon after his birth, or who somehow, in effect, becomes, so to speak, the child of Nono, the grandchild of Nono, because you see the old man Nono walking side by side with the crow in the very village in which he stays. And the villagers say it was as if he has come home with a grandchild. And look at the pace, the slow pace that he keeps with the. One of the things that I was interested in was to show that that the boundaries between the human and animal life is so very thin that it's not worth bothering with.
In fact, that is very well understood. What's fascinating about this book, Secrets, is that we know about Kalaman's bonds with animals and with the natural world. We are suddenly told, almost as an aside, that he spent a year and a half in a prison for defending his grandfather. In other words, the world of the day-to-day politics and retribution techniques of despots is secondary, barely a minutia compared to the continuities of the world that this young man inherits.
Yes, and yet if we also continue along those lines, that continuity, whether a grandson continues the grandfather in terms of, you know, clan lineage or not, is also becomes the center of the debate. And therefore, when it is discovered that he is not, in actual fact, the biological son of Nono, Grandpa then leaves all his property to him, saying that you are my son, and because we share more than blood. We share love. We have always shared affection. Because to me, what is quite fascinating to look back as I wrote the novel, it's taken me many, many years to write it, because I first finished the first draft of Secrets in 1993 and then did a second draft and finished it in 1995. And it was only after going back to Mogadishu after 22 years of being in exile. And only after I was also taken a hostage in Somalia during that visit, that I realized some door inside my head opened. And there I was, able to understand suddenly what I couldn't have understood before, which is that in the life of an African now, you could live simultaneously in very many different worlds and have no problems with the diversity of lives that you lead. You do not become, in inverted commas, schizophrenic, as one might expect.
That's interesting that you say, because you speak of the schizophrenic childhood of being a colonial. You feel that the schizophrenia has been overcome, integrated.
Well, yes, in the sense that colonialism has brought into our lives a discontinuity. Now, that discontinuity is comparable to being a hunchback. Because we say in Somali, even a hunchback eventually gets used to the discomforts with which he must live. Because you cannot change the condition into which you were born or you are born as a colonial subject. You make the best that you can out of very difficult circumstances.
So are you saying then that it is the equivalent of being a functional schizophrenic?
Yes. And then you continue questioning yourself. Sometimes you continue questioning your own sanity. At times you continue wondering where you are, because in every, for example, I'm one of those who has had both the pleasure and also the necessary pain to learn about 6-7 different languages. And one of the reasons why I've had to learn so many different languages was not because I chose to learn these languages, but principally because Somali had no script. And because Somali had no script, I had to learn very many other foreign languages in which I received my formal education so as to become whole. In other words, to move from being in the oral tradition to one of the written tradition. And this functional schizophrenie, as the French might call, would be the one thing that makes living easy, rewarding and enjoyable too.
I'm interested in many aspects of this, but in order. You write in English. I gather that one of the dominant tongues where you grew up in Somalia was Italian, because it was
an Italian colony.
Yes. How did you come to choose English as the language in which you would write, given your options?
Well, given the options, English is my fourth tongue. Somali being the first, Arabic was the second, Amharic, which is the official Ethiopian language, was the third, English was the fourth, and Italian was the fifth. I debated with myself whether to write in Arabic or not at first. Arabic being closer to me because I was born a Muslim and brought up in the Islamic tradition, and in fact I trained as an Islamic priest because I was, you know, the member of the family who was to be devoted to the faith. But in the end, it was technology that made me choose English. And the reason is because the Italian typewriter that I had, the Olivetti, continued breaking down. In Arabic, you couldn't find a typewriter. In Amharic, we wouldn't speak of it because there are 394 letters of the alphabet. Somali, I couldn't write in it because it had no script, not until 1972, mm-hmm. after which I even wrote a novel in Somali soon after Somali became a language with a script. But then I ran into trouble with the state, which discontinued the publication of the novel that I was writing in Somali and which was being serialized in the newspapers. But all this, it became an unnecessary debate when I fell foul of the regime and was threatened with 30 years detention or with sentence of death. And since I could not go back to Somalia, it didn't make sense to continue writing in Somali, which is why I chose to continue writing in English, because at least there is that continuity, because I started writing in English long before Somali was given a script.
I'm speaking to Nuruddin Farah, the author of Secrets, which has recently won the 1998 Newstat Laureate Award. And I wanted to ask you about the relation to the oral tradition. Now, your own work has many ties to that oral tradition. That is to say, characters are constantly getting their bearings by interpreting from folktales, from expressions in Somalia, and the third, from dreams. Dreams are the form of divination for understanding. And I wanted to ask you about the oral traditions in your literature.
Well, let me say, first of all, that I come from a long line of oral poets. And it was expected in our family that one of us, my mother gave birth to 10 children, and I'm the fourth. It was expected that one of us might become a poet. And I was somehow chosen by my mother because I look more like her father than any of my other brothers or sisters. And not only that, but I am the exact replica of my uncle, my maternal uncle. But not only that physical link, but she found in me and then invested in me a certain sensibility. Given that she, having given birth to 10 children, didn't have the time to compose her oral poetry. Because, you know, it takes a long time to raise 10 children, one after the other.
Or to write a poem.
Or to write a poem. So she would lock herself in a room to compose Burambur lyrics that are usually composed by women poets as opposed to the men, classical men poetry. Now, I remember sitting outside this room and waiting for her to compose the poem, which would usually be recited by someone else. Once she composed it, she would recite it before somebody else. And the reason is because the poet does not necessarily recite the poem himself or herself in front of an audience. Because the poet would rather he or she took their distance once the work is done, someone else takes it and then brings life into it. Now, my mother used to then recite the poem to me because I had an excellent memory. And then since she didn't know how to read and write in the European sense of the term, but was an oral poet, she would compose the poem, she would ask me to memorize it, and then like the carrier of a message, she would sometimes ask me to deliver the word, so to speak, the message, the reciter.
That's fascinating. So that in a way, in this book, you're helping me to understand something that fascinates me about your writing. The characters feel as if they are, yes, inheritors and bearers of information and traditions that they may not themselves know. And we, as we read, learn along with them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What traditions they are, in fact, unmindfully delivering.
Yes, yes. Because as a child, I had no idea of the value of the message that I was carrying. It was as if I were given a letter to carry to someone else. And sometimes my mother would herself choose to go and deliver it, or the reciter would come. And because she had many other things to do, having composed the poem and recited it to me, she would then get on with the rest of her business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is how I first got interested in poetry and in the oral tradition. And this is also how I began to understand the act of creation, because the act of creation was part of a process of knowing oneself. And having known oneself, then you tested it against what other people knew about you. You become the bearer of a message, the bearer of a wisdom. You are the custodian of someone's past, the predictor of the future. And all these things get together, and most people do not know, you see, the treasures that they themselves contain until they deliver it. And it's this burden, the secret in the novel that they need to, and people need to unburden themselves, which is the reason why towards the end of the novel, Nono, who is in his 80s, says, "It's time I went."
I've been speaking to Nuruddin Farah, the author most recently of Secrets from Arcade Books. I want to say that I have wanted to speak to you and to meet you for many years, and it's a great honor and pleasure.
It's mine too.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. Additional production assistance by Alan Howard and development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.